Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Jeremy continues our series called Let Me Tell You a Story as we look at the region of Kiriath Jearim. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Jeremy.
So, good morning, South Harbor. My name's Jeremy, one of the pastors here. Excited to be with you this morning. We're kind of in this like kind of 3-week sermon series that we're calling "Let Me Tell You a Story." And we get it; we're spelling the word "tell" wrong, right? Just kind of we faded out the second L, so you know that we didn't just spell it wrong on accident. We are looking. Essentially, what we're doing is we're taking some locations kind of around the land of Israel and asking, what can we learn from the geography, from the physical space of a city, of a site where some of the stories happened? And so question, what is a tell? Well, a tell is what we understand as kind of like layers of ancient civilization. So to show you a tell, this, if we go to that next slide, this is an image of the ancient city of Colossae. So when Paul wrote his letter to the church in Colossae, we know it as Colossians. Do you see this weird-looking hill right here? You got all the mountains in the back. You got a modern city. Do you see that guy? It's just a little grassy hill. I wasn't thinking about the drum box when I put this picture up. That little kind of grassy hill is all that exists of ancient Colossae. We a couple weeks ago, we were here, and it was raining, but we drove right past it. We pointed out, this was Colossae. Right now, there's really nothing to see because it's a grassy hill. They started excavating it about 8 months ago, and so those of us that like nerd out on this stuff are super excited about it because there are things in the ground that I'm sure once they find them will help us better understand the city of Colossae and will then help us understand better the letter that Paul wrote to the city, to the church in the city of Colossae. And so what we're doing in the series is we're kind of taking one of these tells. In the ancient world, often what would happen is you would live in a city, you would do life in your city, you work in your city, you trade in your city, and then at some point, because of a number of different reasons, could be an earthquake, could be another empire comes in and defeats you, essentially your city collapses. Over the next hundred years, dirt kind of fills in, your rubble kind of, it just kind of becomes part of the dirt. They then rebuild on top of it, and then, 100 years later, another earthquake, another enemy. And what you have is in these hills, you have multiple layers of civilization, and so many times in our scriptures, some of the stories that we read, we can better understand if we actually unearth some different layers of the tell, of how the story happened in a location informs the later story. So what we're doing is we're taking a look at some of those places. And this morning, I want to bring you to a place that you've probably never even heard about. It's a city that the few times that Tim and I, we've led trips to Israel, we've always gone to this place. Nobody's ever heard of it. It's a location that, like, as I was writing this morning's sermon, you know how spell checks sometimes, like, you misspell something and it just gives a squiggly line, but it leaves it misspelled? And other times you type something and spell check is like, there's no way you meant that. And it, like, auto-changes it for you. My computer kept auto-changing this one, so I actually had to make it, like, learn the name of the city. Because this is, it's an obscure city. It's a place you probably never heard of. And for me, it's a place that I think of often because I think it brings a necessary, I think it brings a challenge. I think it brings, to me, it highlights something that I think is necessary for my life and I think for all of us. And so I'm gonna bring you to a place, but to get there, I want to jump into the story. So we're going to be in 1 Samuel 4. So if you follow along, most of what we're going to be doing is in 1 Samuel chapter 4. So we're going to kick off at verse 1. It says, now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. And as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel asked, "Why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh so that he may go with us and save us from the hands of our enemies." Now, pause just a little bit and kind of back up. What's going on in the story? Well, the Israelite people, they are kind of entering into kind of the promised land. They're going in, they're trying to kind of push out some of the people in the promised land. There's a whole other sermon around what's going on in that. And did God tell them to go defeat all these other people? Did they live in a worldview that told them, that essentially informed them that if we go in and defeat you, it's because our God is bigger, our God is stronger, and therefore our God ordained it. There's a whole other sermon going on there. But the Israelite people are going into this land. They're going against some of the enemies, one of them being the Philistines. And in this story, they go in, they attack the Philistines, and they're decimated. They lose 4,000 people in this battle. And what I find fascinating is kind of the response that the elders give, right? It's in that last sentence, the response the elders give, they said, "Let us bring the Ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh." So first, let's start there. What is the Ark of the Covenant? Well, if you were here when we kind of walked through our Exodus series, the Ark of the Covenant is this structure that God had the Israelite people build. A picture of it, there's a location in kind of the southern Negev of Israel that they've kind of reconstructed a tabernacle and an ark. This is essentially what we think the Ark of the Covenant may have looked like. So essentially, you have a box. You have a kind of, it's carried by poles that go through rings. And then you have these winged, like celestial beings. They're called cherubim. And the cherubim essentially sit on both sides of the box facing the middle. And what they believed is that essentially, yes, God is everywhere, but they had kind of an idea and understanding that although God is everywhere, God is kind of his presence is kind of most acutely, essentially right in between these cherubim. They call it the mercy seat. So they had this understanding that this would have gone in the Holy of Holies, kind of that like holiest room in the tabernacle. Later when they build the temple, the Ark of the Covenant will go in the temple. But essentially God kind of lives here. If God lives anywhere, God, they understood, kind of lives here. One of the questions I always asked is, who came up, like, why that? That feels like a weird, if you're gonna identify any place where God lives, a weird box with winged animals on top is a weird choice, right? Unless you kind of pay attention to where the Israelites are coming out of and the worldview that they're carrying. And then you notice some differences. The Israelites, not long before, had spent 430 years in Egypt. One of the fascinating things we find in Egypt is for a number of gods, they were recognized. This is from the Shrine of Anubis. What do you recognize? A box carried by poles. This one, interestingly, this is actually a depiction of the Egyptian god Anubis. And so how do you carry around the image of the god? On top of this box carried by poles. There's another relief, another kind of depiction. This is from a temple of Amun-Ra. Football season is coming. If you can notice, it's a little bit harder to tell because it's kind of inscription, but you notice you have all these kind of people on the bottom. They're carrying something that is, they're carrying it by poles, and there is a box right here that is understood to like carry kind of the image of Amun-Ra. And so they come out of a world where this is kind of how the gods were depicted. But one of the differences you find in the Ark of the Covenant, if you go back to ours, one of the fascinating things is early on, the Israelite people, sure, there's a box with poles, you've got your winged cherubim, but one of the fascinating things is in their world, you would always carry a statue or an image of the god. And they recognized from the very beginning that the God of the Israelites could not be contained to a statue or an icon or an image. You essentially have these winged creatures. the presence of God cannot be contained by an image, by a statue, but this is where they understood the presence of God to be, which is why I find the story we started with fascinating. Because if you go back to that statement of the elders, right, the Israelites, they went in against the Philistines, battle the Philistines, 4,000 people die. The elders, they remember, they have this idea that essentially God told them, go into the land, keep me, like follow me as you go into this land, keep me at the center. And what do the elders recognize? After they lost 4,000 people, essentially their response is, oh, maybe it's because we forgot to even bring God along. Right? They recognize, oh, we went out and we tried to do this thing, but the whole time, the Ark of the Covenant, what they understood to be the presence of God, they left somewhere else. And so they said, okay, tell you what we got to do. So we tried to do it on our own, we got defeated, 4,000 of our people died, but if we go get God and we bring God along, God will surely bless the thing that we were trying to do without him already anyways, right? So what they do, they send out and they get the Ark of the Covenant. They bring the Ark of the Covenant in. They essentially ask God, like, just rubber stamp the thing that we were going to do without you anyways. Just bless this thing. And so they go back into battle again against the Philistines. It's in verse 4. It says, so the people sent men to Shiloh, and they brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who was enthroned between the cherubim. And Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, great cartoon, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. When the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came into the camp, all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, "What's all this shouting in the Hebrew camp?" When they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. "A god has come into the camp," they said. "Oh no, nothing like this has happened before." They're freaking out. "We're doomed. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Be strong, Philistines. Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. At first battle, we're going to go take on the Philistines. They lose 4,000. The elders say, "Oh, you know why we lost? You know why we lost? Because we forgot to bring God along. Just go get him, bring him along, ask him to bless what we were going to do without him anyways, and then things will turn." But for the Israelites, what we find is it went from bad to worse. They lose 4,000 the first time. They lose 30,000 the second time. Not only that, Eli, that guy that kind of served as high priest, his two sons, who kind of served as priests with the ark, they're killed, and the Ark of the Covenant is lost. So for the Israelites, you think worst case scenario, this is worse, right? Not only are they defeated, the priests have been killed, and the Ark of the Covenant, the thing that they believe, like of all places, if God lives anywhere, God lives here, is gone. It's in the hands of the Philistines. And to show you how big a deal it was to these Israelites that they would lose the Ark of the Covenant, there's a wild story that comes right next. It's in the next verse about how big a deal this was to lose the Ark of the Covenant. And it all has to do with, you know, that like Phinehas and Ferb, like the priests, like their dad, Eli, he learns of what happened. Check this out. It says, Eli, dad, heard the outcry and asked, "What is the meaning of this uproar?" The man hurried over to Eli, who Eli was 98 years old and whose eyes had failed so that he could not see. He told Eli, "I have just come from the battle line. I fled from it this very day." Eli asked, "What happened, my son?" The man who brought the news replied, Israel fled before the Philistines, and the army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. When he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell backwards off his chair by the side of the gate. His neck was broken, and he died, for he was an old man, and he was very heavy. He had led Israel 40 years. Wild story, right? Like, Eli, like, there's a lot of noise. What happened? And they tell him that his two kids are dead, and he just kind of rolls with it. They tell him the Ark of the God of God has been captured, and then the author, like, he falls off his chair and dies. And he doesn't just die. Like, the author kind of has to do him dirty, right? Like, why'd he die? Because he was old and fat. It's like, in the words of the kids, like, brah, right? You gotta go there. But Eli finds out the Ark of God is gone, and he falls over and dies. This is the worst thing you could ever imagine. They lost the presence of God. And now to the Philistines, what? Like, you not only just defeated these people, right? They came in to attack you. You defeated them. You then just straight up decimated them. And not only have you defeated them, in their minds, they've also captured the presence of their God. Is there a better way to completely defeat an enemy than to both conquer them and take away their God? About what we find, and I'm going to kind of like cliff notes the next part of the story, because the Philistines, what they find is they bring the Ark of the Covenant, this Ark of God, into the land of the Philistines. And what they find is every city the Ark goes to, people start getting like boils and tumors and skin diseases. We're going to spend more time on that story later this summer. So like if like boils and tumors and skin diseases are like that's your jam, hang out. We'll get into that story this summer. But the Philistines, essentially, they get to the spot where they recognize, we can't keep doing this. We've got to figure out, like, why is this happening? Are the boils from this God of the Israelites? Or, like, did somebody, like, eat an infected mouse on a bird-watching tour in a landfill? Like, what's going on? And so they hatch out a plan that essentially their plan, they're going to take this Ark of the Covenant, they're going to hook it up to two cows. Let me show you the plan. It says, now then, get a new cart ready with two cows that have calved and have never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart, but take their calves away and pen them up. Take the Ark of the Lord, put it on the cart, and in a chest beside it, put the gold objects you're sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way. But keep watching it. If it goes up to its own territory, to the area of Israel, then the Lord has brought this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we'll know that it was not by his hand that struck us, but it just happened by chance. It's an odd plan, right? Like, take these two cows, put a cart behind it, put the Ark on the cart, send them off, and then just, like, follow it and watch. If it goes back to Israel, we know it was because this God of the Israelites. If it stays in the land of the Philistines, we know it was because somebody got into something, and now we've got these weird rashes. They hook it up. They send it off. Maybe surprising or not surprisingly, the two cows go right into the land of Israel. And then we read it kind of comes to rest here. It says, they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath Yearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the Ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to your town. So the men of Kiriath Yearim came and took up the Ark of the Lord. They brought it to Abinadab's house on a hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the Ark of the Lord. The Ark remained at Kiriath Yearim a long time, 20 years in all. So this morning, I want to spend some time thinking about this city, this site, Kiriath Yearim. Show of hands, how many of you, like, you've ever heard the words Kiriath Yearim? A couple of you are able to cheat a little bit. On our trips to Israel, we brought some of you to Kiriath Yearim. So if I brought you and you didn't show a hand, we got to go back and check your notes afterwards. But Kiriath Yearim, this city, you probably never heard of, a city where for 20 years, the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of God, sits. So I want to kind of like explore that story and why that matters. And starting, I want to identify where is Kiryat Yearim. So if we go to a map of Israel, you've got the Mediterranean, you've got Sea of Galilee, Dead Sea, Jordan River connects them. I want to zoom in on this area. That next slide, what we've got is we've got Kiryat Yearim is a city that exists about exactly 7 miles just outside of kind of west, a little bit north of the city of Jerusalem. And so Kiryat Yearim is the place where when the Ark of the Covenant comes back into Israel, it says they brought it into Kiryat Yearim and there it would sit for 20 years. Fascinatingly, one of the things that archaeologists have found more recently in Kiryat Yearim is on this next slide. There's a monastery up on top of like the dominant hill in Kiryat Yearim. And what archaeologists have discovered is there are retaining walls right around side kind of the peak of that hill that show about the 8th century BC, there existed a massive platform right on top of the hill. It's led some archaeologists to speculate, is it possible that this massive platform was built so that when the Ark of the Covenant sat in Kiryat Yearim for 20 years, it sat there? Or is it something they built a little bit later to commemorate the spot where the Ark of the Covenant was located for those 20 years? But either way, they found a monster structure right at the top of the hill that shows this site was significant. Something happened here in this place where the Ark of the Covenant sat for 20 years. Unfortunately, we can't find a lot of it because most of the excavations would have to happen under the modern-day monastery, and usually monasteries don't like it when you rip up their floor and start digging underground. So we don't know what the center would have looked like. On the bottom is kind of like an artistic rendering of what that platform would have looked like. But for 20 years, the Ark of the Covenant, the place where God lives, sits in Kiryat Yearim. Now, where I find that fascinating is over those 20 years, life is still happening in Israel. They're still going about their, they're still, worship is still happening in Israel. Worship at this time, the temple is not built yet. The temple will be built by David's son. That'll come a little bit later, Solomon. But during this time, worship is still happening at the tabernacle. Tabernacle is kind of like a portable tent. But inside the tabernacle, what's supposed to be in the tabernacle? The ark, the presence of God. And yet for 20 years, they're just continuing to do worship in the tabernacle while the ark is essentially just forgotten about on a hillside 7 miles outside of Jerusalem in the city of Kiryat Yearim. And yet, the people are just kind of still going about their business. And it feels to me they lost the ark because they essentially said, we can just do it on our own. We don't really need God. Unless things fall apart, then maybe we'll remember and we'll call out to him. But for the most part, we can just kind of do it on our own. We don't really need him. The Ark of the Covenant finds its way back in, and it feels like the people are just continuing to do, to live, to make decisions the way they did beforehand. Worship is still happening, but the presence of God is somewhere else. Government is still happening. They're choosing leaders. They will identify, and they will anoint, they'll call their first king during the 20 years when the presence of God is largely forgotten about on a hillside in Kiryat Yearim. And when we find they identify for their first king, notice the way the first thing, the dominant thing you hear about this first king, his name is Saul, and it shows up here. It says there was a Benjamite man of standing whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, the son of Zohar. There's a bunch of grandpas. Verse 2, Kish had a son named Saul, as handsome a young man as could be found anywhere in Israel, and he was a head taller than anyone else. What did Israel like about their king? About the guy they wanted to be king? He was tall and he was handsome. What does it tell you about his character? What does it tell you about his values, his morals, the way he orders his life? Nothing. What you find is he was tall and he was handsome, and the Israelites looked at him and said, this looks like a king. The story, if you actually kind of follow it, you find the only stories we get of this Saul is he's tasked with kind of shepherding, with watching over his dad's sheep, and he loses them. The king of Israel is often compared to a shepherd. He can't even watch his dad's sheep. And then when they go to anoint him, he's hiding amongst the luggage. But when they find him, again, you're told he was tall and he was pretty. And so the Israelites said, this is the guy we want to lead us. And he guesses how well that story goes? Not well. But it feels like they were doing what they were doing first. It feels like they were still living into this, we're just going to do whatever seems right to us. And then when things go wrong or if things go bad, then we'll call out to God and we'll ask God to like save us from ourselves or bless the decisions that we are already made in spite of him. But we're just kind of continuing on our way. And it feels like things continue that way until this next king. Saul is chosen because he's tall and he's beautiful. The king that will follow Saul is a guy who's chosen because of something very different. The next king is not tall. He is not the obvious choice. The next king will actually be anointed by this prophet, a guy by the name of Samuel. Samuel will show up to this next king's dad and tell him, like, hey, one of your sons is going to be king. And the dad doesn't even think to bring this next king out. He's overlooked. It can't be this guy. You know his name by David. David's the guy that his dad, when said one of your sons will be king, he didn't even think about David. David's the youngest. But what was David doing when all the other sons were being paraded out? He was watching dad's sheep. David was a very different king. And interestingly, one of the first things David's going to do when David becomes king, he's going to establish Jerusalem as like the capital. And then one of the first things he does is this in 1 Chronicles 13. David says, let us bring the ark of our God back to us. For we did not inquire of it during the reign of Saul. Those words, did not inquire of it, could actually be translated as like we neglected it. Like we just went on our way. We didn't even bother with it. During the time of Saul, the whole assembly agreed to do this because it seemed right to all the people. So David assembled all Israel from the Sheor River in Egypt to Lebo Hamath to bring the Ark of God from Kiriat Yearim. David and all Israel went to Bala of Judah, that is Kiriat Yearim, to bring up from there the Ark of God, the Lord, who is enthroned between the cherubim, the Ark that is called by his name. To David, David understood that God isn't something we're just going to tack on the end. God isn't something that we're just going to leave in the peripheral, that we're going to leave on the fringes. God isn't just something that we're going to remember or call out to when things go poorly. David said, no. What we need to do, what we've always been called to do, what we're always supposed to do, is not keep God at the fringes, not have him 7 miles outside of Jerusalem, sitting on a hillside, largely forgotten. But we need to bring God right into the center of all of it, into the way the kingdom's going to work, into all of it. God's not just on the peripheral, on the fringes. God needs to be brought into the center. And so for me, I think about the city of Kiriat Yearim a lot because I think it's a necessary reminder, and I think it's a needed challenge. Because I think what the Israelites were guilty of, like, wouldn't it be great if the past was just the past and, like, we get to look at our world and say, we do it so much better. And yet, if I'm honest, I wonder how much of the way our world works or the way my life works often feels a lot like what the people fell into, where they just went about and did whatever they thought was right. And just tried to tack God onto the side. Religion was still happening. They were still going through the motions at the tabernacle, and the whole time the presence of God was somewhere else. And it makes me wonder, in how many ways hasn't kind of the larger church right? It would be really easy just to go about our motions and do the things and things get comfortable, and the whole time you create something that doesn't even look like Jesus. How easy it is to go about my life thinking, I know what's best. I can make the decisions for me. How often in parenting, right? It's really easy to think, I'm just going to do whatever I think is best. I'm going to try to force my kid into a certain type of individual, a certain image, and the whole time just hoping that like God's just going to bless whatever decisions I'm making. That it's easy to keep God at the fringes when the invitation, I think, is to bring God right into the center. And then there's then the kind of next layer. There's something else that happened in the city of Kiryat Yearim that I find absolutely fascinating. If we go back to the map, in 2019, archaeologists, one of the fun things about archaeology is they're always still finding things. In 2019, archaeologists working in Kiryat Yearim, they found that there was like a city wall just on the outside of the city that they found had been like fortified right around the 2nd century BC. And when they found the wall, it gave them a clue that maybe this city is another city we know of in our New Testament. Maybe this city changed names from Kiryat Yearim into the New Testament city of Emmaus. We know the city of Emmaus had a wall that was fortified in the 2nd century BC. Archaeologists in Kiryat Yearim found a wall that was fortified in the 2nd century BC. And so they started speculating. They actually made a statement that they believe that Kiryat Yearim, by the time of our New Testament, was known by the name of a city, Emmaus. If Emmaus is new to you, we'll get to that story in a second. To be fair, there was a site that was believed to be Emmaus for a number of years prior. I'll put that on a map as well. Emmaus Nicopolis. One of the hard things with archaeology, you know how like you drive into Byron Center and like there's the sign of like, you are now entering the city limits of Byron Center. It would have been awesome if they did that in the ancient world. They didn't. And so there are some cities that like they were a thing a long time ago, and then over time it continued to be a city, and so you know it's the ancient city because it's still a city known by the same name. And then there are cities like Emmaus, where it was a city during the time of Jesus, during the time of the New Testament, but then at some point it stopped to be a city. And so archaeologists then have to try to figure out, okay, where is Emmaus and what blocks and what dirt on what hill is the city they knew to be Emmaus? And so, yeah, 2019, they speculated that Kiryat Yearim is it. Prior to that, they thought it was the previous one. Does this make, that's a little bit technical, does that make sense? Okay, so there's a story that's going to happen in Emmaus, or kind of on the way to Emmaus. Happens here in Luke 24. It says, Luke 24, verse 13, says, now that same day, two of them, okay, two questions here, what day? Luke 24 is happening essentially on the day that Jesus is resurrected. He's risen. What we know is that Jesus rose. Some women were the first people to find out. They went and told the disciples. Disciples had a couple different reactions. Peter runs to the tomb to verify that, like, he's not actually there. Two of the other disciples are heading off on a journey, okay? So two disciples, same day. That same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Okay, if we go back to our map, notice my personal problem with this being Emmaus. This is about 16 miles from Jerusalem. How far was Kiryat Yearim? 7 miles. So they are heading towards Emmaus. They're on kind of this road on the way to Emmaus. One of the things I find interesting as well is if they're on a road leaving Jerusalem, if we were to overlay, this is not all of the Roman roads, but if we overlay some of the major Roman roads, what do you notice? The road from Jerusalem is going to pass right through what was Kiryat Yearim, which might have actually been Emmaus. And so whether they were heading to this as Emmaus or they were heading to this as Emmaus, they would have gone right through the location where the Ark of the Covenant sat for 20 years, largely forgotten on a hillside. And as they're heading either to that city or potentially through that city, Jesus is going to have a conversation with these disciples. It's going to look like this. It says they were talking to each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked right along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked them. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it's the third day since all of this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us what they had seen, that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, 'How foolish you are and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did the Messiah have to suffer? Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going further. But they urged him strongly, 'Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and it opened the scriptures to us?'" What I find fascinating is either, if we go back to that map, either on the road to the place where the presence of God existed but was largely forgotten about and ignored for 20 years, or through that sight to the other, Jesus is having a conversation, essentially helping these two see that, like, it's kind of happening again, right? In him, the presence of God isn't just contained to, like, a space on top of a box, but in Jesus, the presence of God took on flesh and bone and was walking amongst them, and just like the Ark of the Covenant was largely kind of ignored and pushed to the side, Jesus is showing them that God has come even closer and that, again, the establishment completely missed it. They completely missed it. It's happening again. And Jesus was showing them that he, the presence of God, was right there amongst them. Religion is still happening. Politics is still happening. Light, everything's still happening. And the presence of God is largely ignored. Because I think isn't it easier to keep God at the fringes than it is, especially when the way of God confronts something, right? With the religious establishment, when the way of Jesus confronted so much of what was happening, it's way easier just to keep him on the fringes, just where needed. If things fall apart, we can then check in with him. We can ask God to bail us out. But it's way easier to keep him on the fringes than it is to bring him to the center and recognize that maybe some things need to change. The city of Kiryat Yearim, for me, is so important because, again, I think it's a reminder that what was true of them is so easily true of us, is so easily true of me. And I think it's a challenge to not just relegate the presence of God to the edges. When things fall apart, I reach out, but to actually bring him right into the center. And it makes me think of a concept. It's something that I think I heard it first from a guy by the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I believe. But it's this idea. That I think is prevalent in our world, where it's essentially called the God of the gaps. And what it essentially means is, if we think of the totality of, like, what we understand to be true about the world or about our lives, that essentially we say that if we think of let's go with life, right? There's a lot that our science can tell us about how life starts and what happens, and there's cause and effects, and things happen, and there's a point when we're no longer able to explain things anymore. And once we get to a point where we can't explain it, how does a fetus, at what point does a life gain consciousness and become a living, breathing human? We say we can explain a bunch of things, but there's a little bit that, like, we still can't explain. So that we attribute to God. So if you think of like the totality of understanding, we can explain a bunch of it, and then the little bit at the end that we can't yet, we say, oh, well, that's God. Or we try to explain, we try to identify anything. There's what we can explain, then there's God. But do you see the problem with it? The problem is once we learn something else, once we're able to explain more, what happens to the gap that we attribute to God? It keeps shrinking, right? So there's what we know, what we understand, and then there's what we give to God. I think it plays in the way we understand the world. I think it also plays in the way that we often live our lives, that we have, think of if the line, think of like my marriage. I can do whatever I think is right, how I think is right, and then when things, if things don't go well, if things are falling apart, then I reach out to God as a way of trying to bail me out or to bless the things that I'm already deciding, or my career. I could make all kinds of decisions based on all kinds of reasons, right? Like I could chase a bigger income, I could chase whatever, and then at the very end, if I'm feeling unfulfilled, I could then ask God to bail me out, as opposed to placing God in the center of it, asking God, what is it you're calling me to be as a parent? God, what is the unique individual that you are calling my child to be, and how can I partner with you in helping my child become the person that God, you are calling them to be, instead of forcing them into a box that I want them to fit in? Does this make sense? I think the invitation of the scriptures, the invitation, the challenge to me of Kiryat Yarim is to remove the idea of God of the gaps and instead to recognize that God is in all of it, that God should be the center of all of it and how I live my life and in the way that I understand the world. So instead of I can explain so much and I give God the fringe at the end that I can't explain, I think the invitation is to recognize that God is in all of it. That even the things we can understand and we can explain should point us to the one who authored it, who created it, who holds all things together. But to me, again, that site of Kiryat Yarim is a reminder to keep God right at the center. And so how do I do that? Well, there's a practice. I want to end with just a practice. It's a practice that I find when I do this the best, when I do this well in my life, it's often around a practice that I would call the examine, where it's something that I try to do every morning and every evening, and then if I can, kind of at transition moments in the middle of my day. And what it looks like is in the morning when I wake up, like, you know, like before you wake up and just start doom scrolling your phone, right? Like to wake up and actually think about what's coming forward in your day. Meetings that you're gonna have, places you're gonna be, people you're gonna see. And what I will do when I do this well is in the morning, I'll lift those things up to God. I'll pray at the beginning of the day, just asking God, like, hey, in the things that I'm planning on today, may I be aware of your presence in it? I'll ask God to lead, to guide some things, but I'll start my day by praying over it. And then at the end of the day, I'll look back over the day and I'll ask myself, like, how aware was I of the presence of God in kind of each moment along the way? Was I attentive? Was I alert? Or was I just kind of going about my own business with the presence of God, kind of ignored or forgotten about on a hillside, right? And so I'll kind of ask at the end of the day, I'll kind of look back over it. And then at the end of the day, in all of the things that I think I did well and that I wish I could do over, I just kind of commit those to God and commit tomorrow, I'm going to start back over. And then there are times where like the drive in between work and home, I'll kind of do the same sort of practice to look back and look forward. But to me, it's kind of a practice that I offer as a way that's helped me do that of trying to keep God in the center. So would you pray with me? God, we do pray that we can model a way of life, a way of church, a way of faith that doesn't just tack you onto the edges, asking you to bail us out or to fix or to bless the things that we're already committing ourselves to, but that we would place you at the center, that we would give our lives to chasing after you in all of the things that we find ourselves in and all the things that we give ourselves to. God, we pray that you would be the center. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church, we want to wish you a blessed week.